Blog Talk Radio. It's time for Monday Night Radio. Monday night is your night to talk with the experts. Call us now to get into the queue at 866-MONDAY-6. That's 866-MONDAY-6. Call us now or email your questions and comments to comments@mondaynightradio.com or tweet them to us at Monday Radio. And now, here's your host, Ann P. Mitchell, Esquire.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Monday Night Radio. I am very excited. Our Canadian listeners can now call our toll-free Monday Night hotline, and that's really exciting because we are always happy to help out and save everyone a little money, so it's really awesome that they can call. Actually, anyone anywhere in North America can now use the toll-free number, and that number is 866-MONDAY-6, and now listeners anywhere else in the entire world can call our direct line. That number is 347-857-3122. Again, that's 347-857-3122. So we are now truly global with the ability to hear from our listeners anywhere in the world. Very, very exciting. I also, speaking of calling in, want to remind you that we invite all of our listeners to call in and tell us what you think about anything at all at any time. You can call that same Monday night hotline, 866-MONDAY-6, anytime, day or night, and leave us a message telling us what's on your mind. So, as an example, we had someone call in who wanted to talk to us about the Juan Williams firing that happened last week. As you may recall, Mr. Williams, an NPR correspondent, was on Larry King and made some interesting comments about how he was nervous when he boarded an airplane and would see someone dressed in Muslim garb. And that was very un-PC of him, and so NPR let him go. And so here is what one of our listeners had to say.
Yes, I was commenting on this email I received concerning the firing of Juan Williams. I don't believe he should have been fired. People get nervous over a lot of different things, and just because he made that comment, I don't see that as being so insensitive that he should have been fired. As for me, I see someone in different types of attire that would not make me nervous.
So what do you think? Again, tell us what you think about anything. It doesn't have to be about the Juan Williams firing, which to you may be old news by now. But what's on your mind? Let us know at 866-MONDAY-6. But do wait till after the show. Call in now to talk to this show's expert. And I am so pleased to be able to have this guest on our show. What many of you don't know, in fact, probably no one listening knows until I reveal it now, is that there was a time when I was diagnosed by proxy, if you will, as having ADD, or as it's now known, ADHD. And that was because a family member of mine was diagnosed as having it. And there is, as we will learn, I think, tonight, a very strong likelihood that if someone in your family, in your direct lineage, parent, child, has it, there's a very good chance you have it as well. On the other hand, there are many, many people who are diagnosed with having ADHD, ADD, who don't actually have it. In fact, as our guest is going to tell us, there are many other conditions that can mimic ADHD. And countless children, adults as well, but especially the children in our school systems, are diagnosed as having ADHD, are medicated for ADHD, when in fact they don't have ADHD at all. And I think that's just a travesty. So our guest, who I'm about to bring on, is Dr. Frank Barnhill. He is a medical doctor. In fact, he's been practicing family medicine and ADHD behavioral medicine for almost 30 years. And he has a new book out. Well, actually, I think it's new. I have to confess, I'm not sure that it is new, but he does have a book out, and I have been reading it, and it's really wonderful, and I will let him tell you about that, because without further ado, I would like to get Dr. Barnhill on the line. Dr. Barnhill, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening, and thanks for having me.
Oh, welcome to the show, Dr. Barnhill. I am so excited to have you on the show, and I have to tell you, the switchboard is already lighting up, which is just wonderful, and I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Well, I had no idea that we were dealing with a previous victim of ADHD diagnosis. Most people who are highly successful in life, especially gifted people, those in the what I call the technical industry and the entertainment industry, have been misdiagnosed with ADHD in the past. A lot of their gifted traits were mistaken. Kids who are gifted and who end up holding prominent public positions usually are very curious. They have insatiable curiosity, and they're often mislabeled as ADHD based on their impulsivity and their drive, their creative stamina, as I put it. Maybe that happened with you.
I have to tell you, Dr. Barnhill, that I don't know whether I was misdiagnosed or not diagnosed, because, again, it was just one of those, your family member has it, so you must have it too. But I have to tell you that I have always thought of my style of attending and thinking as being a feature, not a bug. It was quite a shock to me to learn that not everyone can do 3 or 5 things at once and do them all successfully. So I kind of think not being able to do that would be a hindrance.
Oh, I agree. A lot of experts will agree with you now, because we're going through this catharsis over misdiagnosis of ADHD. Suddenly, everyone agrees that we're misdiagnosing too many children. All the news stories lately espousing that 1.1 million kids last year were misdiagnosed and mislabeled as ADHD, those are just eye-opening. And you see more and more content on the Internet about gifted children now who have been mistaken for ADHD. And there are so many kids that, like you, have an insatiable drive, or able to multitask, or able to hyper-focus, or able to create and do more in a shorter period, that have been mislabeled, that it's pitiful. I see more and more of these children in the office every week.
Dr. Barnhill, I have so many questions for you, and our callers have questions, but I would like to bring something up that has been just sticking in my craw ever since I researched it. And my numbers are old, and you, I'm sure, have better numbers and can speak to this more knowledgeably, certainly, than I. But we have a son. My son is 12 and a half right now, and we always knew that we were going to homeschool, and in part it was because we always knew he was very bright. As a boy, we knew he would get bored to tears very quickly in the traditional public school setting, and we knew he'd act up and he'd get labeled and they would want to medicate him, and we just knew that the odds of that were very great. And as we were making these decisions, I did some research, and at that time, and this was several years ago, what I found absolutely horrified me. What I found was, at that time in the United States, across all states, in the public school system, 17% of elementary school children had been diagnosed with ADHD and were medicated. And of those children, 80% of them were boys. Can you talk to that a little bit? And I don't know, again, if you have more current numbers, but I was shocked and horrified.
Well, your numbers, of course, date back a few years. Currently, it depends on which resource you use, we believe as few as 6 million and as many as 9.5 million children in the United States alone have been diagnosed as ADHD. Of those, the Centers for Disease Control estimates currently at the end of 2009 that 70% are receiving medication for ADHD. That means between 6 and 7 million children are getting drugs every day for attention deficit hyperdysplasia. You know, it's just it's unreal the number of children that are being treated for ADHD with drugs.
And in your expert opinion, based on your practice and the research that you've done, of that, and oh my gosh, I just have to say, that is a disgusting, astonishing number. Of those up to nine and a half million children labeled as ADHD, 70% of whom are on medication in the United States, what percentage in your experience truly have ADHD and need or would respond to medication?
Approximately 25% have been misdiagnosed as ADHD. In other words, 75% of that number probably are ADHD or have what I call incomplete ADHD symptoms, which means they don't have the disability associated with ADHD. Of those, probably half don't need medication.
Wow.
So we have as many. One of the authors from North Carolina State that produced those numbers about 1.1 million children being misdiagnosed last year, we had a discussion a couple of weeks ago, and he agreed with me. The current number is more like 2.5 million children have been misdiagnosed in 2009 as ADHD, and of those, 70% of those, unfortunately, are on ADHD drugs that they really don't need to be on. They're being treated for diseases that are not ADHD. As I try to emphasize with parents that until you know what disease is actually causing your child's behavior or misbehavior, you can't really adequately treat it. And
right.
A lot of these children are evaluated in really quick office visits by doctors. Sometimes moms tell me the office visits last as little as 15 to 20 minutes, and the doctor basically gives a quick, thorough workup that culminates in the child being tried on the medication. One of the fallacies that we have in the medical profession about ADHD is that if you start a child on ADHD medications and he or she gets better, her behavior gets better, or his attention span gets better, or his hyperactivity gets better, then that means it's ADHD. And nothing could be further from the truth. Because a child responds to ADHD medication doesn't mean they're ADHD.
You know, I have so much more to bring up with you. And first, let me say that the name of Dr. Barnhill's book is Mistaken for ADHD, How You Can Prevent Mislabeling Your Child as a Failure in Life in the Face of a Looming ADHD Misdiagnosis Crisis. But really, all you need to do to plug in at Amazon is plug in Mistaken for ADHD. And if you have a question or a comment or a story to share, please give us a call on our hotline at 866-MONDAY-6. Again, that's 866-MONDAY-6. You can call in from anywhere in North America on that line. If you're outside of North America, you can call us at 347-857-3122. Or you can drop us a comment by email at comments@mondaynightradio.com or tweet us at Monday Radio. Now, before we go any further, Dr. Barnhill, we have someone on the line who says that she almost died from a misdiagnosis. So let's bring her on the line now, because that's right what we're talking about. If I can get her, come on. Oh. Martha, are you there?
Thank you.
Hi. Welcome to Monday Night Radio with Ann and Dr. Barnhill.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm very lucky to be here.
It sounds like it. What's your story?
Well, I was diagnosed with ADHD. I was I initially went to a psychiatrist. It was my junior year of college, and I went to Emory University in Atlanta, which is a top 20 school. So this was, and it was really when they just started diagnosing, I think, more ADHD. My father had been earlier in the year had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and I started to have difficulty concentrating and remaining in the rigorous curriculum of my university. And I went to a psychiatrist, and she was started to treat me, and she was also a counselor. And she began to treat me for depression, and then wanted to see if I was, in fact, ADHD. And they diagnosed me as ADHD, and the medication that they put me on, Adderall, wound up causing a hidden arrhythmia to present itself while I was running on a treadmill a year and a half later. And I actually died and had to be defibrillated back to life. And they think the arrhythmia was triggered by the medication and the dosage that was administered.
That's quite a story, Dr. Barnhill. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that is an accurate analysis of what can happen with that medication. In fact, approximately a year ago, the FDA issued what we call a black box warning about the stimulants that are used to treat ADHD. And this black box warning essentially said all ADHD stimulants can cause cardiac arrhythmias, can cause an irregular heartbeat, can cause palpitations. And this is especially true in people who have pre-existing heart disease, whether it's a bad valve or an irregular heartbeat in the past. And there have been 5 documented deaths related to the use of ADHD stimulants and irregular heartbeat. Those have occurred mostly in teenagers. So that's a very accurate story. It's almost classic for what happens when a person has a hypersensitivity reaction to the medications. That's very interesting.
You know, well, one thing that I had as, you know, going on, because what they found so unusual was really that by all other accounts, and I'm not sure, doctor, if this is something that you'd be able to answer or if it's more for my cardiologist, because they never really were able to provide, you know, any advice afterwards. And I really had a lot, and I have to say I've had tons of support, especially from the American Heart Association, on dealing with the repercussions of something like this. But they never really said, I had to actually they had to shock me back into a rhythm for my heart to go that in that particular, it never would have pronounced itself without the medication. Does that make sense? It wasn't an arrhythmia that you could see normally. They had to do an EP study.
Right. The workup for that type of cardiac problem needs to include what's called mapping of the pathways, the electrical pathways and inside the heart, and that's a very specialized type of cardiology. Those doctors, I know in our area there are only five servicing probably 2 million people. So there is that's a very, very specialized cardiology consultant, and you may wish to find one of those and explain.
I already have had one that I had to see, but at continuing with the diagnosis, really what I wanted to, you know, to ask you so many years later, I've really been a lot more successful. I'm a publicist, so I do a lot of different things at once and have not had a problem with it without any kind of medication. And I'm also really...
It sounds like that they actually were fixing something that wasn't a problem.
It really felt that way, and I was wondering if you found in your experience, if it in a diagnosis of patients later, say in their 20s, and it's during, do you ever see that where someone has something that is really traumatic in their life, and they can't concentrate, that diagnosis is, if that's common, if depression and ADHD are ever confused.
Okay, we're going to let Dr. Barnhill answer that. And Martha, I'm going to thank you for the call very much. And doctor, is that something that you see, that people have some other stress that causes them to have a hard time focusing? I mean, that's very well known that a large stress, as in this last caller's case, she had the situation with her father. And then it looks like ADHD, but gosh, I mean, shouldn't the medical community or the psychiatric community realize that when you have a big shock in your life, that makes it difficult to focus? That's not a great time to be looking at something as ADHD, is it?
No, it's not. One of the things that we emphasize when I give lectures to doctors is first make sure that whatever you're going to utilize is not going to cause the person to lose the edge that they have in life. You know, we all have the ability to a certain extent to handle major changes in our life, major stressors in our life. And if you over-medicate a person, you take away their ability to deal with that stress. And unfortunately, the stimulants used in ADHD do that. If a person truly is not ADHD, and you place them on a stimulant, what you're doing is slowing them down. You're slowing their thought processing down, and they are no longer able to handle the stress they were dealing with. So I suspect what happened here is situational depression, anxiety, handling the grief of a sick father, handling the loss of control, and suddenly being placed on medication for ADHD, which slowed all of those skills down, all of those techniques for coping, precipitated an event. And part of the event was the arrhythmia directly related to the medication. And then, of course, once you're no longer on the medication, you're able to better cope with all the problems that are occurring.
So ironically, that in that case, they created more of a problem than had already existed. You're listening to Monday Night Radio. Our guest is Dr. Frank Barnhill. He has written a book called Mistaken for ADHD, and we're talking about, among other things, misdiagnosis of ADHD. And Dr. Barnhill, before I go on, let me just tell everyone that they can call in and talk with you or ask you a question or tell a story. Call 866-MONDAY-6. That's our toll-free number from anywhere in North America, 866-MONDAY-6. If you are outside of North America, you can still call and talk with Dr. Barnhill at 347-857-3122. If you don't want to call, you can send us an email and we will relay it to the good doctor at comments@mondaynightradio.com or tweet us at Monday Radio. Now, Dr. Barnhill, one of the things that you say in your book that is just, it's towards the beginning. And again, you know, this sort of goes back to my own research and decision to homeschool, et cetera. You say of the teaching style in schools, simply telling children what to learn and then blaming them when they don't understand something is how kids get labeled so easily. And then you go on to talk about learning styles. And if I may, just a little quote from the book, you're talking about yourself as a child and your father kind of finally getting that you were a very hands-on learner, that you really had, you're what we call a tactile learner. And you said that you think your father finally realized that I needed to have my hands on things I was expected to learn. I needed not only to see them, but to feel them, to touch them and mentally absorb their substance. And you say, go on to say, we now recognize those visual tactile skills as being essential to a child's ability to learn and store the memory of what he or she has just learned. And yet, that really is still not what goes on in many, many schools. And so I'd like to ask you to talk about that a little bit. I know we have some callers that want to talk about the learning style connection. And I'd also like to start that off with a question, which is, I myself, my style of learning and the way that I went through college and law school was by writing my notes, that the very act of sitting in a lecture and committing to paper, that the process of putting pencil to paper and moving my hand and writing those notes, I usually didn't ever have to study from the notes again. But that very act of committing what I needed to know to paper and writing notes is what really made it possible for me to retain what I needed to retain. And I'm wondering if you think that that very act in itself is one of those sort of hands-on mechanisms.
That's truly a hands-on mechanism. It's one that I used in medical school. Most medical school students subscribe to what's called a transcription service. But I took longhand notes all the way through medical school and rarely had to look at them again. It's called concrete ideation. In other words, you are making your memory permanent by taking an active part physically in storing the memory. It's the same thing as a child in a classroom being handed a boat, a toy boat, and then explain what a boat is and teach the child how to spell the word boat. The child's memory becomes concrete based on touching the boat and simultaneously learning what a boat is and how to spell the word boat. The problem that we see in children, in school children now, is our society wants to place them in what I call the cookie cutter mold. It's easier to teach 30 children in a classroom if all of the kids advance at the same rate, are learning the same lesson, are able to sit still and pay attention, and develop the same social skills and have the same testing skills. We have failed to recognize in most cases that each child has his or her own individual skill set. They all have a different capacity for learning, and that includes different capacities for what they hear, see, feel, touch, sense, even smell, because a child learns based on the seven senses. Those senses allow the child to input, to take in information, then process the information, which basically means figure out what's going on, and then store that information for future use or immediate use. They decide what to do with the information after it's processed. And not every child can process information as rapidly as another, and they don't certainly process it in the same manner. I'll give you an example. Had a child that we evaluated for ADHD several months ago based strictly on the teacher stating that every time the child took a test, he wanted to stand up by his desk and tap his foot. And after he tapped his foot for 2 or 3 minutes, He could sit down and answer two or three questions, and he would stand back up and tap his foot again for two or three minutes. And this went on and on until she called the mom and she said, "Your son's obviously ADHD. He's disrupting the class when he takes exams, and I can't put up with this. You've got to do something immediately." Of course, you know, he's 8 years old. We took a look at the child. He clearly wasn't ADHD. He has a learning skill set that's different from every other child. After speaking with his teacher about it, I explained that if she would allow him to take his exam standing all of the time, he didn't have to sit down after he tapped his foot, he could improve his grades dramatically. And, of course, that's what happened. He would stand at a higher desk and constantly tap his foot while he took his exam. And she made arrangements for him to do that out of the visual field of the children, so it didn't disrupt the class. And his grades went up, and we were able to keep him off of ADHD medications.
Well, that is such a perfect example, and, you know, just what it brings to mind for me is, you know, when are we going to stop labeling children who have different learning styles at all? Because there are probably as many learning styles in a given classroom as there are children. Let's go to Christine on the line. She's calling from San Diego, and she very much wanted to talk about learning styles and ADD. First, let me just remind our other listeners that you, too, can call in to talk with Dr. Barnhill. The number to call in is 866-MONDAY-6. If you're outside of North America, call us at 347-857-3122. Christine, are you there?
I am here.
Thank you for waiting so very patiently.
My pleasure. I've been enjoying listening. I'm so glad that someone is... Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air with Anne and Dr. Barnhill.
I'm so glad that you're talking about this. This is such an important subject. I see it every day. How the kids suffer in the schools from this very, very thing that you're just talking about. I wanted to ask Dr. Barnhill, did you ever do any research into the connection between food allergies and ADHD and ADD?
Yes. While researching for Mistaken for ADHD, went through all of the current literature associated with food dyes, specific food allergies, excessive intake of sugar byproducts, artificial sweeteners, pretty much cover the entire gambit. The problem that I found in the research is that there really are no good research studies that support any specific food, artificial sweetener, or chemical, or whatever, for causation of ADHD symptoms. That's not to say that it doesn't occur. What I tell parents about food and other chemicals, especially preservatives, red dye, yellow dye, all of the dyes, is every child's metabolism is different. If your child becomes hyper, inattentive, impulsive, can't focus, unruly, develops a behavior problem, when you notice this when he or she eats a specific food or is exposed to a specific food coloring, a dye or a chemical, then that your child may just be reacting to that chemical, and you should withhold that chemical or that food from their diet. As far back as 27 years ago, I had a little boy in the practice, 6 years old, and every time that child had candy that had red dye number 5 in it, or any type of soft drink, any type of food that was red, orange, pink, he became terrible. His behavior was horrible. And we basically put him on a red dye-free diet for 3 months, and his behavior improved. Now, would I be willing to say that that child developed ADHD as a result of red dye number 5? No. What I would say is red dye number 5 caused that child to have a behavior disorder that looked a lot like ADHD. And we probably, quote, cured the child's ADHD by restricting his red dye intake.
Yes, and I would bet money that a lot of teachers see these behaviors and just turn right around and tell the parents the kids are ADD. I've actually seen a report done by a school psychologist that said in the report that the child showed all the symptoms of it, and they weren't going to do anything for the child until the parents took him to the doctor and got him on drugs. And that, to me, goes totally against the whole point of the IEP, which is to support the child in learning at the school. And it's appalling to me what's going on in the schools. I'm so glad you're talking about this.
Christine, may I ask you a question? What's your relationship to this? Do you work in the school system, or are you a concerned parent, or how are you seeing all these?
I've been a professional tutor working with learning disabled kids for 20 years, and I think in that time I've actually only seen 2 kids that I would say were actually ADHD. They were unmistakably crazy. Although, judging by what they ate, I would say that their food had a lot to do with it, because all I ever saw them eating was sugar. But most of the time, what I see is I get a kid who's a kinesthetic learner who actually needs to physically move around in order to be able to process information, and the teachers are screaming at the parents to drug them. And they and a lot of parents thankfully won't, or they at least will seek someone who knows something about it and say, what do you think? Well, it's pretty easy to tell if someone is kinesthetic or ADHD, because here's what I always ask them. Well, okay, if you're playing a video game, how long can you sit there and play your video game? And they'll say, oh, hours. I just focus on it. Doesn't that kind of go against the definition of what ADD is supposed to be, which is a lack of being able to focus? So I always say we're probably dealing with a kinesthetic learner, and then I approach them in the tutoring sessions that way, and all of a sudden they start learning.
Good. That's so wonderful. They have you.
Yeah.
Well, Christine, thank you so very much for the call, and I just want to commend to you and the listeners out there, you brought this to mind. I don't know if you're familiar with the TED Talks. But there's one in particular, and you can find it on the TED website, which is TED.com. If you search for Ken Robinson, Ken Robinson has a wonderful talk about this very thing, and he talks about a child that that he saw that was, you know, being told that she had some sort of, I don't know if they were diagnosing it as ADHD, but she was just this problem child because she would just dance around all the time. And it's a wonderful story. So I would commend that to you. Dr. Barnhill, I would like to talk a bit before we run out of time about those so-called zebras, the diseases that kind of can hide in the grass looking like ADHD, but are in fact other diseases, and I'm sure these lead to many of the misdiagnoses. Let me just remind everyone to call in at 866-MONDAY-6. That's 866-MONDAY-6 if you're in North America. If you're outside of North America, give us a call at 347-857-3122, or you can email your questions and comments to comments@mondaynightradio.com or tweet us at Monday Radio. So Dr. Barnhill, the two other things, well, actually one thing before this, which just goes to, again, the schools and what Christine was saying, you have a line in your book where you say that as more children in the school district are diagnosed with ADHD, more and more federal funds are allocated for the education of those children. Now, that's a pretty straightforward, common sense thing to say, but also it's pretty damning, because you have to imagine that the teachers who are trying to deal with these children who have these different learning styles are well aware that if they can get a diagnosis, they can get more funding. And it could be altruistic. They're thinking, okay, well, more funding means we can help these kids. But that's a little bit like the tail wagging the dog, don't you think?
No, that's true. And unfortunately, there have been a lot of research programs both in Australia and in Canada to deal with this. In fact, the Austrian Royal Medicine Society issued a statement a little over a year ago that America was experiencing an epidemic of ADHD diagnosis based on funding for federal programs through the school system, and that Australia would like to avoid doing the same. There have been a couple of articles in the Canadian medical literature to the same effect in the last 6 months. While what you say is true, it's sort of a double-edged sword. If you need more funds for IEPs and for teachers, then you have to diagnose more ADHD and more learning disability and more behavioral problems. If you need to improve what you already have, then, of course, you've got to get more money from somewhere. So it creates a conundrum. It creates a problem such that children actually may be driven toward the diagnosis of ADHD based on perceived need.
And now let's talk about what might be, assuming there is anything wrong with these children. And again, I certainly don't consider a learning style to be anything other than just that, a learning style, and not something wrong. But you have in your book 10 different possible precipitants, if you will, that could lead to symptoms that appear to be ADHD. And these are, I understand, to be the underlying things that can present to cause someone to be misdiagnosed as ADHD. Some of them are diseases. Some of them are environmental factors. Some of them are social and behavioral issues. And so would you be willing to just sort of go down that list of 10 and speak a little tiny bit about each one?
Sure. Let's cover the list based on the type of disease. One of my favorites is thyroid disease. I see this a lot, especially in little girls. Little girls come in misdiagnosed as ADHD, inattentive type. They can't pay attention. They daydream in class. They end up having low thyroid hormones. The thyroids just quit working. And once their thyroid hormone is replaced through supplements, their ADHD symptoms just go away. Their inattentiveness is gone. You can have hyperthyroidism, which is too much thyroid hormone. See this in little boys. Usually they're very impulsive, they're wound up, they can't sit still, their thyroid is in overdrive. So they end up being hyper, of course, and once you take care of their thyroid problem, they slow down and they go back more toward what you would consider the activity of a normal child. You have problems such as lead poisoning, which is very obvious. In the United States, that was primarily from eating paint at one time. Now, unfortunately, it's primarily from children living near landfills and toxic spills that were covered up, and the lead leaches through the ground into their play areas. We still see some lead poisoning in children who live in homes, older homes that were renovated and the paint had been stripped off, but the dust containing the lead had not been cleaned out of the carpet or the floor or the wood joints in the floor, and they inhale the dust and they become lead toxic. Children who have low iron levels, anemia, meaning low blood, they're very tired. They're inattentive. They fall asleep at their desk. The teacher thinks they have the inattentive type of ADHD because they can't focus. If you spend $4 a month on iron supplement for these children, and they get better really rapidly as their hemoglobin goes up. Then you have the new diseases, as we call them, called pre-diabetes. These are conditions where children are not quite diabetic, but they're one step away from being diabetic, and they suffer surges in their blood sugar. It's sort of like the young lady was talking earlier when she called in about kids who had learning disabilities and they were on sugar all the time. Well, sugar-loaded children a lot of times are pre-diabetic, and they'll eat a lot of sugar. Their blood sugar, their blood glucose will go very high, and they become hyperactive as a result, and it's hard to get them to focus and to study. And then 3 or 4 hours later, when they haven't consumed any sugar, the blood sugar drops back down into the normal range, and guess what? Their behavior improves. Prediabetes is a cause of mistaken ADHD. Diabetes, of course, can be a cause because of the same reasons, blood sugar fluctuating. You can have a multitude of problems that involve the adrenal glands. Those are the glands that sit on top of the kidneys and supply adrenaline, the chemical that gives us that rush when we need to respond to danger and frustration. Children who have adrenal dysfunction, of course, are hyper. They are wound up. They're hard to contain. And once their adrenal problems are treated, then their hyperactivity goes away and they're able to focus. See a lot of children who have what we call disordered sleep. One of my favorites, a little boy named Benji, 10 years old. The child came in on 3 ADHD medications. Mom had the classic history. I know everyone's heard this. You've got to do something. I can't take it anymore. He keeps bringing home bad report cards. He's failing. His teacher told me if he doesn't get better, if things don't get better, he's going to fail this year, and it's already January. And, well, Benji wasn't ADHD. Benji stood 4'9" tall and weighed 222 pounds.
Oh, my God.
He was only 9 years old. And Benji had obstructive sleep apnea. He was not breathing well at night. The oxygen level was dropping very low. You know, when you don't sleep well at night and you come close to waking up as many as 20 and 30 times an hour, then you're so tired the next day, you can't concentrate, you can't focus. We cured Benji. He lost 65 pounds in 1 year using a combination of diet medications and exercise. And within 6 months of the second year, his sleep apnea had improved to the point that he didn't need therapy. And, of course, he had no ADHD symptoms at that point either. Just a simple cure with weight loss and taking care of his breathing problem. Isn't that awesome? That just the human body is so adaptable that just a change in weight made a difference.
That's pretty amazing. We have another caller on the line with a question. So is this a good time? And I know you have some other other things that can lead to these symptoms. We've only got about 10 minutes left, and I do want to get to this caller. So can you remember what you haven't told us about yet? So we can get to the All right, that'd be great. And again, caller, listeners, you can call in at 866-MONDAY-6. And now let's go to Gabe in Chicago. Gabe, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
You have been so patient, Gabe. Thank you so much. Do you have a question for Dr. Barnhill?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you've been talking about a lot about how ADHD drugs are overprescribed. I was just wondering what you think is kind of behind that. Do you think it might have something to do with the fee-for-service payment system that we have with a lot of practices and hospitals in this country? because I know that's been related by a lot of people to healthcare overutilization in other areas? Or what other factors do you think might be causing too many prescriptions of ADHD drugs?
Oh, wow. Good question. Difficult answer.
Excuse me, just a minute. Gabe, do you have your speaker on?
Yeah, I do.
Could you mute it, please?
Yeah, hold on one.
Thank you.
There it is.
All right. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Dr. Barnhill.
Great. Yeah, that's a really good question. It requires a multi-pronged answer, though. There's several things that drive the use of ADHD medications. Number one is pharmaceutical companies have done a really, really great job of educating doctors and the general public about the use of ADHD medications. Number two, it's very easy to start a child on ADHD medications. Those stimulants are easy to write. I mean, you know, parents come in, they're about to pull their last gray hair out because their child's behavior is terrible, they're failing in school, they want to do something, they want a quick fix. They want the fix to be today. Actually, they want it yesterday, but they'll settle for today. And they want the medicine started because they know, you know, the kid next door is on it, there's a kid down the street on it, and they've heard how once the medicine was started, the child's grades went up, the behavior got better, so they want the fix. They want it then. That drives the use of ADHD medications. It's a quick fix. It's trying. What parents want is they want their child to live a normal life, and they want their family to live a normal life. They want their life back. Their life has been taken away. Nothing's normal when you live with a child that's been labeled as ADHD. That child and the family suffer discrimination. They suffer bias. I've had one family in the last 3 years that ended up in divorce because their child was misdiagnosed as ADHD.
Oh, wow.
Those are the things that have it, yeah. It's tough.
Yeah, so
really tough.
So you think it's more like this desire on parents' part to kind of want a quick fix or like a magic bullet for, you know, their kids' problems and any sort of like wider societal issue that's driving this?
Well, teachers want a quick fix,
right?
Not just the parents. I blame everybody equally. I know doctors who want a quick fix for the child too. I've given many courses on ADHD, and doctors would say, look, you know, I had this kid in the office a few weeks ago who was clearly ADHD. He was into all of my cabinets, turned over the trash cans. I couldn't get a word in edgewise. I felt so sorry for the woman. I just thought, no, I'm going to go ahead and put this kid on something today because this kid's driving her nuts, and I can see how he's driving her nuts. My argument there is that doctor is responding just like the school teacher and just like the parent. And as we discussed earlier, everybody needs to sort of take a step back and slow down and go, okay, this may really not be ADHD. This could be something else. And if we don't know what it is and we try to treat it, we may really harm this child. We may cause physical harm, sort of like the lady with the Adderall and the cardiac arrhythmia. We may cause emotional harm. We may cause this child to fail academically. We may affect this child's ability to socialize with friends. We may affect this child's ability to grow into an adult who's capable of keeping a job and falling in love and getting married and having children. So we need to slow down a little. We need to take a couple of steps back, look at the child's behavior. I mean, it's sort of like the child we were talking about earlier who could only take exams effectively while he was standing at the desk tapping his foot. I don't see anything wrong with that. I think that we should accommodate children. Kinesthetic learners, for example, have to touch things or, you know, have some type of overstimulation, some type of sensory stimulation in order to learn accurately and adequately, and we should accommodate those. The rest of the kids in the class probably would get a kick out of everyone passing a toy around to learn how to spell the word associated with the toy.
Gabe, thank you
That's
so much for the call. That really interesting question there. And you know, one thing I wanted to throw out there, doctor, and you can bear me out here, is also the detail people who visit you, doctors, they give you pre-printed prescription pads. They make it so easy for you to reach for that pad and just write the patient's name on it, check off a dosage, and there you have it. So I blame not the detail people, but I kind of blame the pharmaceutical companies a little bit. We're in one of the only countries, if not the only country in the world, where you can turn on the television and be told by the pharmaceutical company to go tell your doctor to give you the purple pill. So I blame them a little bit. Doctor, we have only 4 minutes left, and so I know we are not going to get to all of those other things that can be masked as ADHD. People are just going to have to go to Amazon, do it now, and get Dr. Barnhill's book. It's called Mistaken for ADHD, and some of the things that he wasn't able to get to that may look like ADHD are diseases of the pancreas, neurological problems, mild autism spectrum disorders. We mentioned food and drug ingestion, even though not in this particular part of the show, social and behavioral issues. And doctor, you have just a couple of minutes left, and I'm sure it's not enough time to cover this, but if you could just talk for a moment to this. You have a couple of chapters about diagnosing ADHD the wrong way and diagnosing it the right way. Can you just very quickly elaborate on what the wrong way is for people out there, so if they run into it, they'll know to run the other way?
That's one of my pet peeves, and yes, I love to talk about it. In Mistaken for ADHD, the chapter that deals with diagnosing ADHD the wrong way is targeted specifically at parents. Parents need to become strong advocates in their child's health care. If you walk into a doctor's office and asking for your child to be evaluated for ADHD, and that doctor gives you an ADHD diagnosis, number one, without talking to the child, number two, without doing any type of blood work, and number three, in less than three office visits, you're in trouble. You
that
cannot
is a great...
accurately diagnose it without those elements. There's no way. Yeah.
Those
and
are great
all,
rules of thumb.
You know,
so number one, they should talk to the child. Number two, they should do blood work. And number three, they should have had at least three office visits before medicating your child for ADHD. Doctor, we have one last
Correct.
Question from the chat room, and I'm going to just throw it out there really quickly. Hopefully we can it can be a fairly simple answer, because I definitely want to get to this. And she asks, are neuropsychologists claims that ADHD is on the same spectrum as autism. Do you agree with that, doctor?
That is a good question, too. Both are probably neurodevelopmental disorders. That's true. With neurodevelopmental disorders, you have processing input deficiencies. In other words, sensory processing does not occur accurately. And with all of the new research in ADHD indicating that it is neurodevelopmental and genetic, there is a high probability they are in the same spectrum. And that spectrum probably includes Asperger's syndrome. It's almost a joke in the medical field now that Asperger's syndrome is going to be the next ADHD epidemic. That's where we're
Doctor,
headed.
Thank you. thank you so much for joining us. This has been so interesting, so enlightening. Dr. Frank Barnhill, his book is Mistaken for ADHD. You can get it on Amazon. I highly recommend that you do. It's a very interesting read. Dr. Barnhill, will you come back?
Oh, I'm more than glad to come back. And anyone, listen, anyone who did not get an opportunity to ask their question, if you will go to my website, ADHDbehavior.com, that's ADHDbehavior.com, you can email me anytime you want to and ask a question. And you can follow our current threads on my blog, takenforadhd.com. And you can email me from the blog, too. I'll be more than happy to answer questions. And I'd love to come back. Just ask me.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you so much.